final case this morning is Vollmer v. Selden.
May it please the court.
There's a little switch. You can raise that podium higher up. It's down on your lower right. A little switch in the podium. You can raise it up.
Looks like you're going the wrong way.
Maybe I shouldn't have told you. All right. I figured you'd be more comfortable with it higher.
Thank you, Your Honor. The district court, may it please the court. The district court in this case, following what may be best called a hunch that what it considered claim jumpers were going to try to interfere with the settlement, accepted the plaintiff's claim that my clients were claim jumpers and proceeded to hit them with a drastic sua sponte fine. In doing so, the district court ignored this court's mandate, committed significant errors of law, and based his ruling on factual findings that not only have no basis in the record but are uniformly contradicted by the record should therefore be reversed. The key ruling, we think, is to be found on page 559 of the appendix, where the district court said at the end of the second paragraph, page 2 of his opinion, Selden and Rosenthal put forth Mr. Hawk as an objector for an improper purpose. And the real question is, what is the improper purpose? In the context of the paragraph to which this is the concluding sentence, it appears that the improper purpose was to extort a fee for themselves, something that was shown by the fact that Hawk was completely unfamiliar with the basic components of the settlement. Now, we have several problems with that reasoning. First, we make no bones about the fact that my clients got into this case hoping to be paid. Most lawyers get into cases hoping to be paid. There's nothing wrong with that. I assume that's true of my adversaries in this case. Not quite true for me.
Well, I assume there are two ways a lawyer coming into a class action like this could hope to be paid. One is to sweeten the pot and hope to be paid from the increment.
Right.
The other is to complicate matters and hope to be paid to go away.
That's right.
And what does the record show about which of these two options, which of these two possibilities...
What the record shows is that the district judge did not address that question. You sent this case back for specific findings based on evidence specifically pointed out in the record. And the district judge used the catchphrase to extort a fee for themselves, but didn't discuss where that came from, didn't discuss the evidence. Now, what's potentially wrong about hoping to be paid is bringing frivolous objections. And if the district court had made findings that there were frivolous objections, this might be a different case, although we would take issue with those findings. The word frivolous is sprinkled through the red brief, characterizing this appeal as well, I might add. But you will look in vain in the district court's written order for anything, any mention of frivolousness. Now, Selden and Rosenthal submitted evidence of their pre-filing investigation. You'll find that in the appendix at pages 529 to 531. There's other material in the appendix at 215 to 217 and 222 to 224. The district court's order does not show any consideration of that, and we think there are several reasons for that. First of all, the district judge decided to impose sanctions before Selden and Rosenthal had put forth their objections. So his decision couldn't have been made on the basis of the frivolousness of the objection. Several others had the same objection. Several dozens, really, of attorneys general. The AARP, not to speak of the other lawyers from Missouri. Class counsel, the month before Rule 11 was raised sua sponte by the district judge.
Is the issue their motive, isn't that the issue before us?
The question...
Not whether the objection was objectively supportable.
I think the question is whether they had an improper purpose, and hoping to be paid by bringing non-frivolous objections is not an improper purpose. That's my basic point. Class counsel...
It just depends on whether the objection is frivolous or not.
I would say if the notion is that they were hoping to be paid and that was a bad purpose, that has to be hoping to be paid by bringing frivolous objections. The settlement was improved after Selden and Rosenthal objected. And the district court...
Well, in my dichotomy, if you had a non-frivolous objection,
right,
but still hoped to be paid for going away rather than for vindicating that objection, in other words, you hope to be paid at the expense of the class rather than by benefiting the class, one would think that's probably sanctionable.
There's no evidence on that question in the record.
There's certainly no finding.
There's no reference to that in the order to show cause.
I confess, I haven't read the whole record, so I don't know.
The order to show cause is set forth in the appendix at pages 517 to 518. There's nothing on that issue in the order to show cause. So to the extent that the order was based on that, it's a violation of the court's mandate. Now, the district court's reliance on Hawke's alleged ignorance of the settlement is also flawed as a basis for sanctions. First of all, it's wrong as a matter of law. A client may be an adequate class representative under Surowitz, even if the client relies on the lawyer and is basically ignorant as to the reasons for the suit. Now, if that's an adequate class representative under Surowitz, it's surely an adequate objector. Now, appellees say that our argument that the district court's reason for looking at Hawke's level of knowledge was legally basis is irrelevant because it goes to a credibility finding. But credibility as to what? There's nothing wrong with a lawyer finding a client. And, in fact, that's not what happened. All of the evidence in this case, the testimony of Hawke and Selden and Rosenthal, was that Hawke came to them, not they came to Hawke. The only basis for the finding to the contrary was discrediting all of the testimony in the record. Now, finally, we have the question of the appellant's practice history.
His wife was their employee, isn't that right?
That's right, and it's quite reasonable that if you go to the lawyer that your wife works for, when you get this complicated document in the mail, which is a class action notice, and say, what does this mean? Is this good or bad? Finally, we have the question of the practice history. The last paragraph on page 59 of the appendix. The court relies on information supplied by class counsel, which tends to show that Selden and Rosenthal routinely engage in such conduct in other courts. The real question is, what's the such conduct? Now, if it's just intervening in nationwide class actions, there's nothing wrong with that. If it's frivolous litigation, if it's intervening for improper purpose, that's different because a past history of improper conduct is properly considered in deciding, this court has decided, properly considered in deciding whether to oppose a Rule 11 sanction. But the cases cited in the memorandum and the cases that the district court thereafter cited don't show that. In fact, some of them were cases in which neither Selden and Rosenthal were lawyers for objectors. And some of them were cases where the court agreed with Selden and Rosenthal and awarded them fees. None were cases where the courts found the kind of wrongdoing with which Selden and Rosenthal are charged here. And so we have a situation like the Great Lakes case that we cited in our Rule 28J letter last week. This court said you can't rely on a history of frivolous conduct unless that conduct has been adjudged to be frivolous. One final point. The real danger from this sanction is the deterrent effect that it's going to have on the necessary and always unpopular job of objecting to class action settlements. If the district court decision in this case stands, that filing an objection in the hope of making money is sanctionable, and because large amounts of money are at stake, sua sponte fines have to be large, lawyers are not going to do these cases. Indeed, the theory of deterrence adopted by the district judge extends beyond class action work. Most federal litigation involves lots of money and large fees. I'm assuming that large fees have been charged by my adversaries, collected by my adversaries. Rule 11 sanctions would always have to be large to have a deterrent effect, but that's not what the 1993 amendments were intended to accomplish, and it's not what this court has said should be accomplished in its post-1993 decision. And for those reasons, both the sanction itself and the amount of the sanction should be reversed. If the court has no questions, I reserve the balance of my time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Levy. Mr. Hoffman.
Thank you, Your Honors. John Hoffman on behalf of the appellees, the class. May it please the court. Your Honors, in your prior opinion, you remanded this case for the court to reconsider its Rule 11 sanctions, and you directed it to do only two things, those being, one, specifically identify the evidence it was relying upon in coming to its conclusion, and two, to allow the attorneys to rebut that evidence. And the court did both things, both during its hearing on January 6th and in its published order filed on January 15th.
Did you justify the amount, which we described as extremely large?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
I say, what did the court do to justify the amount of the sanction, which was described as extremely large in the opinion?
I think that justification is set forth on page 3 of the order, and also if you look at the hearing transcript at pages 11 and 12, the court noted that the settlement money and the settlement benefits were great in this case. It was personally aware of objector payoffs from its own experiences, and it noted that approximately $50,000 in class benefits went in claims because of these actions. There are no guideposts. It is a subjective determination. Your Honor stated in the last opinion that you can't use attorney's fees expended as a basis for setting a yardstick. So if that's gone, and that's contrary to what the Eighth Circuit did in the MCH investment case recently, it said it could be used as a guidepost, but if you throw that out the window, then there are no yardsticks, and it comes down to a subjective determination by the court. And the court said it was basing this on its, basically, its life experiences as to what was necessary, in its opinion, to prevent this conduct from occurring in the future.
What was this conduct that needs to be prevented?
I think the court...
It's pretty much common knowledge that there are an awful lot of unsatisfactorily small class action settlements. There's serious agency problems in which the lawyers for the original class are tempted to sell out the class in order to maximize their own attorney's fees. And you would expect there would be some room for outside monitoring.
There is definitely room for outside monitoring. Right. Nobody is complaining
so
about
that,
the
that
concept
leads,
of objectors.
That leads to the question whether what these lawyers were doing is searching for class actions where the plaintiffs settled for too little and trying to get more, or instead searching for class actions where they could be paid to go away. I mean, the first is beneficial to the class, and the latter is pestilential. And my question is, what is the basis for the conclusion that this case is in the second set rather than the first?
Well, I think there's several bases for that conclusion, but I would point out before identifying those that the district court's closest to the ground. It's in the best position to observe the demeanor.
I agree with that, but I couldn't find any finding on this subject by the district judge.
Well, if you look at page 2 of the January 15th order, the court outlined three or four bases for its imposition of sanctions in this case. One, the lower court found that based upon the questioning of Mr. Hawk, it was satisfied that Mr. Hawk was put forth for an improper purpose, and also that Hawk's motions did, in fact, tend to unnecessarily delay and needlessly increase the cost of litigation. Mr. Hawk did not know where he was, did not know why he was there, he did not know the names of his attorneys, he did not know...
Perfectly normal in class actions.
Well, you
I must say, if that were the ground, most class actions would be dismissed summarily at the pleading stage.
That is one basis, and again, the court was the district court was in the best position to observe the truthfulness and veracity of the witness.
I'm asking a concrete question. There are lots of possibilities, but it seems to me they fall into the two classes I delineate. How do we choose between these two classes? I didn't see any finding, for example, that the lawyers had made a request to be paid to go away. That would be the best sign of bad faith, right? They didn't say, pay us, we're gone, right? It looked, to the extent I could figure it out, like they were hoping to be paid from sweetening the pot. And that would imply that the case is in the first set. They get paid if they sweeten the pot. If they don't sweeten the pot, they don't get paid.
Well,
that not only is beneficial, that's the right set of incentives.
Well, again, it's an abuse of discretion standard. It's not what this court would have done. It's whether the lower court abused its discretion. That was one point, that Mr. Hawk was put forth for an improper purpose. Point two, the court researched Feldman and Rosenthal's past conduct, which again is approved under the advisory committee.
Past conduct is that they've done this, it seems, on average about once a year for a period of some years.
And in Brent versus Feldman.
But what this is just complaining about a class action settlement. It doesn't say whether this is trying to get more for the class or trying to be paid to go away. Are there any findings by the district judge that it's the latter rather than the former?
I think it's obvious from the court's order, and it's the court outlined for three or four factors it was considering in reaching its decision to impose Rule 11 sanctions. Past conduct, the testimony of Hawks, their failure to appear at the hearing, and the baselessness of the pleadings filed in this case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Hoffman. Ms. Jackson.
May it please the Court, Rebecca Jackson on behalf of Publishers Clearinghouse. And, Your Honor, because of the short time here, I'm going to just try to address some of the questions that I've heard here. First of all, I believe in this court's order is replete with factors that create a totality of circumstances that support a finding that these attorneys were, in fact, in this case, looking to be paid to go away. I think it would be...
What is the, in your view, the principal factual foundation for such a belief?
Your Honor, I believe that the principal... It would be hard for me to distinguish between two. The first was the nature of the testimony that was given at the hearing. The trial court was in a position to make a determination about the credibility of the witness. He was evasive. I've noted that the sections of the hearing transcript that relate to his evasiveness are not in the appendix in this case.
The only thing I can find in the district judge's opinion, there's really only one paragraph devoted to it, says that Mr. Hawk's testimony, at which he revealed that he was a layman and didn't really understand his litigation, convincingly proved that Selden and Rosenthal put forth Mr. Hawk as an objector for an improper purpose. That is not a finding that they wanted to be paid to go away. And it's completely consistent with the proposition that they hoped to sweeten the pot and be paid out of any marginal value to the class.
Your Honor, had Mr. Hawk been any kind of a credible witness, the latter position might be a correct inference. But from being present in the courtroom and by reading the transcript where he talks about that, you see Mr. Hawk's evasiveness with respect to how he got to Mr. Selden. He was evasive and misstated what his record had been, and I think that Judge Murphy summarized that when, as did this court, when they said, on its own, Mr. Hawk's testimony and the circumstances surrounding it would provide sufficient justification for the imposition of Rule 11 sanctions. I don't think that you're ever going to find sophisticated lawyers who would make the statement, bad face, pay us, and we'll go away in any way that would be admissible or would be of record evidence in this case. However, you do have attorneys who were given the opportunity on October 8th. The judge entered an order setting out the evidence that he was relying upon. They were given the opportunity to come in person and rebut that evidence. They only presented written responses. And then at the hearing, they declined to appear and address those elements that Judge Murphy said he was relying on in his October 8th order. He had the benefit of their written response, he listened to the presentation by Mr. Levy, and he was not persuaded because he had the benefit of seeing the entire course of conduct. Most importantly, Your Honor, I believe, at the final fairness hearing, these attorneys were given the opportunity on behalf of their client and purportedly on behalf of the class to intervene in this case, and they declined to do so, making it a certainty that this settlement was going to be approved and that approval was going to be upheld by this court, and yet they took an appeal.
Intervening, making it a certainty.
They did not intervene, Your Honor.
The Supreme Court has now held that intervention is unnecessary.
But that was not the law at that time.
Mr. Leedy's organization was involved in that case.
But that was not the law at that time, Your Honor.
Well,
and they.
It was the law at that time. The Supreme Court's position was that this circuit had misunderstood what the law at that time was.
In this circuit, then, the law had not been articulated to that.
It's been articulated incorrectly in this circuit with the holding of the Supreme Court.
And, Your Honor, when these attorneys were given an opportunity to protect the rights of their purported client and this class, they declined. That says volumes about what their purpose was in this litigation. If there are no other questions.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Levy?
I'm tempted not to, but I have wanted to make three brief points.
the order to show cause did not set forth the evidence on which the district court was relying. The order to show cause and the final decision are rather similar. We did submit detailed affidavits and evidence which we were entitled to have considered and apparently were not considered by the district judge. The emphasis on the other side is the abuse of discretion standard. And I think the real problem is there's no indication that the district court either drew the distinction that Judge Easterbrook has made or even was aware that the distinction existed. The district court can't be affirmed on that basis. And finally, Mr. Hoffman made reference to pages 11 and 12 of the transcript in January where the judge allegedly indicated that he had experienced objector payoffs from his own experiences. I don't see that there. Now, I do suspect that his own experiences may have been involved in this case, but we're entitled to know what they were so that we could address them. We think it should be reversed. If it's not reversed, we would urge you to exercise your discretion under Circuit Rule 36.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement. The court will be in recess until tomorrow.